Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for May 28th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, how perceptions of fairness change as we grow up, rediscovering a forgotten corridor between the world's first civilizations, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about a body temperature time machine, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
That's not fair. Almost everyone has heard a child shout those words at some point. But researchers are finding that what children consider fair changes over time. In a paper published in this week's Science, Bachtel Tung Auden and colleagues report that older adolescents come to accept inequalities based on differences in individual achievement as fair, but not inequalities based on luck. Tung Auden is an economist at the Norwegian School of Economics and Business Administration, the NHH.
In the study of adults, people differ in their moral motivation, both in what they think is the morally right or fair thing to do, and they differ with respect to how much they care about such considerations. And then we ask, so where do these differences come from? So are we born with them, or are our moral motivations shaped by different social experiences?
To find out, Tung Auden and colleagues conducted an experiment to see how ideas of fairness develop in children.
And there has been a lot of work in this field, particularly in psychology, but also in economics, on very young children. We look at the older children when they move into adolescence, and there are two main reasons for that. One is that our more recent neurobiological research shows that the brain develops a lot in adolescence, more than we thought previously. And secondly, that in adolescence, you face a lot of new social experiences. And we wanted to see whether these two factors really had an influence on the moral motivation.
So, Tung Auden and his team recruited hundreds of children in Norway in grades 5 through 13 and had them play a game that, at first, meant they worked to earn an income.
So what's nice about this experiment...
Bill Harbaugh is an economist at the University of Oregon and is not affiliated with the study.
...is they make a very serious effort to ensure that the subjects understand that the inequalities in income that the experiment starts off with are the result of differences in the effort of the children who are engaged in it. And so they have this pretty impressive procedure where the children are on the internet, and this maybe hits a little bit too close to home for some people. They've got a choice between doing their job, which is a pretty simple task involving number identification, or getting distracted by a fun internet website with games and so forth on it. And so the harder they work at the task, the less time they spend on the game website, the more that they can earn. And so, in part, the payoffs in the experiment before the measurement of inequality starts are the result of these differences in the effort of the children in a situation that's, you know, very realistic for us these days.
After that, the lucky part. The amount of points each child generated was multiplied by either a high price or a low price, randomly. Then the researchers paired each student with someone at the same grade level, so about the same age, and made one of them the dictator to decide how the total income of both students should be split, knowing what each student had earned and whether each student had been lucky and gotten the higher price for his or her work. Again, study author Bachtel Tung Auden.
I mean, they could take everything if they wanted to, or they could give away everything, or they can do something in between. And then we place them in a sequence of such situations, and then we can study both, in some sense, the level, how much they give away, which is a measure of how fair-minded they are, and also, what's most important in this experiment, the pattern of behavior. Because it's not obvious here that the fair thing to do is to divide equally. Maybe the fair thing to do is to say that you should get in accordance with your contribution. So the guy who produced the most should get the most. Or maybe it should be in accordance with earnings, also saying that, well, if you were lucky, it's fine, it's your luck.
The results? With increasing age, children's sense of fairness changed from strict egalitarianism, finding all inequalities unfair, to meritocratism, where inequalities were fine so long as they were based on individual production, not luck set by the random high or low price. But curiously, in every age group, there was an equal share of what study author Bachtel Tong-Odden describes as libertarians.
The basic feature of libertarianism, what they call libertarianism here, is that, well, people should be held responsible for what caused their earnings. So people should be held responsible for how productive they are, and also responsible for their luck part. And one way people would defend it, in our study it's not about defending it, but one way people might defend it is to say that this is about self-ownership, so what comes to me, I should keep. It's fair that I keep it. That implies that the fair distribution is that each person gets his or her earnings. It's important to note that this fairness ideal is not obviously an easy fairness ideal to follow, because if you meet someone else who has earned a lot of money and you are to decide, well, if you are really a libertarian, you would think that, well, he actually deserves most of it. And we see that in the experiment. Some of the children act in a libertarian way and they sometimes give away really a lot of money.
Remember, this is a series of cross sections. It's not a panel.
Again, Bill Harbaugh of the University of Oregon.
So we don't follow the same child as they age and ask if their preferences are changing. So it's possible that these children change their beliefs as they get older, and some of them become less libertarian, other ones become more libertarian. But we don't know that. I think it's best to take the results, you know, at face value and say that the proportion of people having this preference doesn't change very much. And that, you know, supports the argument. You don't want to say this is genetic, but it supports the argument that that's sort of a fundamental preference that people have, despite the huge difference in people's life experiences and what they're taught in school that happens over the period that they're looking at here, over the age groups that they're looking at, right? It's really a striking result.
It is striking, though, that we see a stable level of libertarians.
Again, study author Bachtel Tung-Odden.
But the fact that we see a very stable level of libertarians shows one very important thing with our study, and that is that our study is not simply a story about people accepting inequalities as they grow older because they are smarter. Because what we see is not a move from a simple view to a more complex view. So this is much more complex than just a simple move from a simple fairness ideal to a more complex one.
And figuring out that complexity will mean studying why students change their fairness ideals. Again, Bill Harbaugh of the University of Oregon.
There's a huge change between 5th grade and 13th grade. Imagine if that change went on a little bit more than it does. We would live in a very different society with respect to popular support for welfare programs and so on than the one that we live in now. So when we see big changes in people's preferences like this, I think it becomes very important to understand what is it that drives those changes in preferences, because we can imagine a little bit less change or a little bit more change having a very big impact on the kind of world that we live in.
But both Harbaugh and study author Tung-Odden say that it's unclear whether the results, based on students from Norway, may be extrapolated to the rest of the world. You can read Tung-Odden and colleagues' paper titled Fairness and the Development of Inequality Acceptance in this week's Science. 21 Canadian forestry companies and 9 environmental groups announced an agreement last week to protect enormous swaths of Canada's boreal forests. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
The Canadian Boreal Forest Agreement, brokered by the Pew Environment Group and involving member companies of the Forest Products Association of Canada, will establish one of the world's largest protected forest areas. Roughly 29 million hectares will be immediately protected from new logging, and 72 million hectares subject to environmentally sensitive logging practices and conservation planning for protection of endangered species. In exchange for industry concessions, the environmental groups agreed to stop promoting their decades-long international campaigns to boycott Canadian lumber. Some issues remain to be settled in order to ensure the strength of the agreement. None of the protected land is actually owned by the companies. Governments and native groups have control, and none have yet formally agreed to limit logging. Also, some forest companies are not part of the Forest Products Association of Canada, and thus are not included in the agreement. The boreal forest, mostly coniferous trees and wetlands, forms a roughly 1,000-kilometer-wide belt across the northern part of the country, encompassing about 75% of Canada's woodlands. The forest is home to thousands of species of plants, animals, and microorganisms. The region also represents an enormous carbon sink, sequestering an estimated 200 billion tons of carbon, making it a potentially valuable tool in efforts to combat human-induced climate change.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with the policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress.
So I went to Amman in January of 2010 in order to explore various sites that archaeologists have been digging in recent years. I'd heard that there were some exciting finds that were being made there.
Science contributing correspondent Andrew Lawler reports in this week's issue on Persian Gulf archaeology and how an obscure region in eastern Arabia served as a crucial trade link while developing a surprisingly sophisticated, independent culture of its own.
But I knew very little about the country, which is pretty much terra incognita to most people in the West. It was actually closed off until the 1970s and was considered as remote a place as Tibet was during most of the last century. So I was eager to find out what archaeologists there were actually finding. And after that visit, I went across the Arabian Sea, across the Indian Ocean, to Gujarat, which is the westernmost province of India. And there were companion finds being made of various sites from the middle of the 3rd millennium BC, that is around 2500 BC, of very large fortified towns and cities that were being discovered that were part of the Indus civilization back at that time. And I was very curious about the links between the cities that were being found in the Indus on the coast in Gujarat and the finds being made in Oman, because there was very strong evidence that the peoples of the Indus were carrying goods as far as Arabia and then on to Mesopotamia.
So is this trade, is this the news that's emerging from these archaeological excavations about how the world's first early civilizations interacted with one another?
Yes, let me give you a little context for that. The old way of seeing how civilization emerged in the old world back in 2000, 3000 BC is that there were several very isolated societies living along river valleys. Obviously, Egypt and the Nile, Mesopotamia with its Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and the Indus civilization on the Indus River in today's India and Pakistan. So the old view was that these societies developed pretty much independently, and they didn't have much contact with one another. But I was always suspicious of that idea, since the ideas like writing and cities and commerce all seemed to pop up at about the same time in all three places. Now we know, based on finds in places like Oman, that in fact these three civilizations were connected. They actually were connected not just by land, but by sea.
So is the idea that they sailed from Oman up the Persian Gulf to Mesopotamia or around to Egypt via the Red Sea?
Well, we know that as early as the 5th millennium BC, so, you know, 5, 6,000 BC, there were people sailing on the Persian Gulf. There was a find made in Kuwait a few years ago in a study that was published that showed that people were capable of traveling long distances in boats. But until the 1980s, it wasn't clear exactly when people began to travel across the open ocean or open seas. And that changed in 1980 or so when Maurizio Tozzi, an archaeologist at the University of Bologna, happened to be on his honeymoon on a beautiful beach in Oman. And when he was there, he happened to uncover some pottery. And the pottery looked oddly familiar to him. He had dug in India and Pakistan before. The pottery, in fact, was made in the Indus River Valley, which is 1,000 kilometers or so due east across the Arabian Sea. It was an astounding find, and when they dug down, when they actually did an archaeological investigation, they found ivory combs, which clearly came from the Indus, made of elephant ivory, as well as a number of signs that were known as Indus symbols from that period. So this was a very important find that showed clearly there was seagoing trade between the Indus River Valley and ancient Arabia. And there was also evidence of trade with Mesopotamia from Arabia. We've known for a long time through the cuneiform texts found in Mesopotamia that that area was receiving huge amounts of copper from Oman. So what you have here is a circuit, a trade circuit that connects the Indus with ancient Oman and Mesopotamia, which were by far the two largest civilizations of the time. The connection with Egypt is a little less clear. There were definitely trade links at a later date, but it's still unclear exactly how far people were sailing and whether Arabian sailors made it to Egypt at that time.
Have researchers been able to figure out what the ocean-going ships were made of?
Yes, there are Mesopotamian texts which give us basically recipes for these boats. And to supplement that data, we also have lots of boat models that appear both in the tombs of Giza, for example, in the Old Kingdom in Egypt. There's a very large boat that was buried with the pharaoh that's been known for a long time, but also a number of models that were found in Mesopotamia as well as the Indus. And so combining these models along with the cuneiform text, researchers have begun to get a pretty good idea that the people of this time, far from being landlubbers, were actually very sophisticated sailors who were building very large ships as early as 2500 BC. Now, that's probably 1,000 or even 2,000 years earlier than people thought.
You mentioned that Oman is rather terra incognito for a lot of archaeologists. Is there some reason why that it's taken until now for these understandings of interconnected early civilizations to emerge?
Yes, Oman was long considered to be a very difficult country to enter. It wasn't until around 1970 or so that a new sultan took power in Oman and began to slowly and gradually westernize and open up that very isolated country. And as a result, Oman today has become a real magnet for many archaeologists because it's very difficult now to dig in large parts of the Middle East, of course, given the political problems and violence in these countries. It's forced archaeologists from this region to look elsewhere. And Oman is a gold mine in that it has not been visited very much, much less excavated.
Beyond the pottery shards and ivory combs and the other bits of evidence that you mentioned, are they finding anything new about the larger civilization there?
Yes. One of the most exciting finds made in Oman is that there was possibly a portage or a trade route across which Indus traders actually traversed. So they might land on the coast of Oman, work their way through the interior where they might trade pots and other goods for copper, which was highly prized in the Bronze Age in the 3rd millennium BC, and then make their way to the coast of the Persian Gulf, where they could then get shipped to Mesopotamia to then trade copper. So it's a very exciting idea that at this time, you could almost say it was a proto-globalization, that at this period, Oman served an important purpose in the international economic system, and that you had quite a bit of trade and diversity going on in what today feels like a very isolated area, which is not economically very important globally. So it's an exciting find that these civilizations, Mesopotamia and the Indus, were connected, and that Arabia played a role in that. And by understanding that, we're getting a better idea of how people mixed and how they passed on ideas, such as building cities, using writing. All the basics of civilization were created during this very brief period in history. But to call the civilization, to put it on equal footing with the Indus and Mesopotamia, would be misleading. Clearly, this was a tribal culture of people who were not building cities and were not engaged in extremely complex, high ritual kinds of activities. However, there are hundreds, even thousands, of very large tombs which these people built of stone that are very finely made that began to appear around 3100 BC or so. And archaeologists once thought that this was a time when there was not a very sophisticated society in Arabia. No one really bothered to look. But once archaeologists got there and began to actually count the number of tombs and to find settlements as well, they discovered that in fact there was what Maurizio Tozzi from the University of Bologna calls the Great Transformation, that the people in this area went from being simple herders and gatherers to building very sophisticated settlements, which included these large stone structures, the use of which is still somewhat mysterious. We know that the tombs were used, of course, for bodies because we can find the skeletons, but these other round structures, which some archaeologists call towers, remain a little mysterious. They clearly were the center of perhaps ritual or defensive purposes in these isolated areas, but we still don't know exactly what was going on.
Andrew Lawler, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Science contributing correspondent Andrew Lawler reports in this week's issue on Persian Gulf archaeology and how an obscure region in eastern Arabia served as a crucial trade link while developing a surprisingly sophisticated, independent culture of its own. Now, David Grimm, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about a body temperature time machine. Dave, something about measuring body temperatures from the past?
You got it, Rob. This story is all about, can we take the temperature of creatures that lived Millions of years ago.
Millions of years ago. How are researchers even considering being able to do that?
Well, actually, it's not outside the realm of possibility. In fact, researchers know that certain isotopes, and these are different varieties of standard atoms, so something like oxygen 18 would be an isotope. Researchers know that isotopes can vary within certain minerals, even minerals in the body, with temperature. But that's really not enough, because the problem is, if you're looking back at an organism that lived millions of years ago, you don't really know what the abundance of the isotope was in the animal, if its diet affected the isotope. There's a lot of confounding factors. So what researchers did in this new study was they focused on a technique that's actually been used to determine temperature fluctuations in limestone. What it is researchers look at the isotope composition of a mineral called bioapatite, which is found in bones and in teeth. And in bioapatite, the isotopes carbon-13 and carbon-18 tend to stick together. But as body temperatures rise, these bonds fall apart, and that changes the amount of bonding you see between these two isotopes. So theoretically, you could determine the temperature of an animal, even an animal that lived millions of years ago, just by looking at this bioapatite in its teeth or in its bones.
So you calibrate this by looking at animals that recently died? Is that what the idea is here?
Well, yeah, researchers wanted to see if this technique actually works. So what they did was they took tooth enamel from elephants, rhinoceroses, crocodiles, alligators, and sharks, all animals that are around today. And they found that when they used the technique, they got the animal's average body temperature to within about 3 degrees, which is pretty impressive. And even more impressive is that these researchers went back and they looked at tooth enamel from two woolly mammoths. And these are animals that died out thousands of years ago. And researchers kind of figured that woolly mammoths had about the same body temperature as their relatives today, like elephants. And in fact, that's what the researchers found. They were also able to determine what they believe was the mammoth's body temperature to within a few degrees of accuracy.
So the idea then is to extend this back even further in time to dinosaurs?
Exactly. There's a really big controversy actually about dinosaurs, which is whether they were warm-blooded like us or they were cold-blooded, more like modern reptiles. And if you're warm-blooded, you've got a body temperature that hovers around 37 degrees Celsius. But if you're cold-blooded, your body temperature can really fluctuate depending on the environment. And the researchers say their next step is to help maybe resolve this controversy. If they can look at bioapatite in the bones of dinosaurs, they may be able to tell once and for all whether these ancient beasts were cold-blooded or warm-blooded.
Are all dinosaurs likely to be one or the other?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. In fact, not all reptiles are cold-blooded. Some are warm-blooded. So it's possible that the researchers would find that some dinosaurs were one and some were the other. But other than actually going back in time and sticking a thermometer in a Tyrannosaurus's mouth, this is probably as close as researchers are going to be able to come to solving this mystery.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of cold-blooded animals, this next story is about frogs and why frogs vibrate just before they fight.
Why are they fighting in the first place?
Well, frogs, like a lot of animals, fight over territory and they fight over females. And this study specifically concerns a species of frog called the red-eyed tree frog. And this is a very cool-looking frog. You can see a picture of it on the site. What happens is these red-eyed tree frog males tend to sit on branches of trees and they produce a sound called a chack, what researchers call a chack sound, to attract females. But sometimes a rival male can hear that chack sound and also want to mate with that female. And so you've got two male frogs that are in competition over the same potential mate. And what the researchers observed is right before these male frogs fight, one of them or both of them will start to briskly wiggle their butts up and down on these trees. And they're usually on these very thin branches. And this causes the branches to vibrate. And one frog would theoretically be able to feel the vibrations caused by the other frog. And the researchers went, you know, there's really not a lot of evidence of animals, especially animals in trees, using vibrations to communicate. Are these frogs actually trying to communicate something to each other by vibrating the branches?
So how did the researchers test what was really going on here?
Well, believe it or not, they used a robotic frog. They constructed a frog that would vibrate the branch at about a frequency of about 12 hertz, which is the same frequency the frogs are causing when they're wiggling their butts up and down on the branches. You actually see a very cool video on the site of the frogs doing this. And in some tests, they had the robot just sort of bob up and down, so sort of mimic the motions of the male frog without actually having the robot vibrate the branch. In other experiments, they actually did have the robot bob up and down and vibrate the branch. And what they found is that in both cases, a nearby male frog would get very agitated and aggressive. But only when the robotic frog actually shook the branch did the other male frog shake the branch as well. So it was sort of like they were communicating with each other. And what the researchers say is that these vibrations are sort of the male frogs communicating with each other, saying, hey, I'm ready to fight. I'm ready to throw down, as it were. And in the wild, what the researchers observe is when frogs make these vibrations to each other, and they both sort of agree via the vibrations that they're ready to fight, they engage in a wrestling contest where they're essentially trying to throw each other off this tree. And the frog that wins is the one that gets the female.
So the researchers are trying to see whether or not there was sight involved here, not just motion.
Right, because there's obviously a lot of examples of animals communicating with visual displays, but there's not a lot of examples of animals that live in trees using vibrations. We know that elephants and even scorpions tend to use vibrations on the ground to communicate. But why these animals might actually use vibrations, why these red-eyed tree frogs might use vibrations, is because often they've got branches and leaves in their way, so they couldn't really see each other necessarily to communicate visually. So this may have evolved for them to have another way of communicating.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, moving on to something that frogs might eat, this last story is about termites and how termites have a very large impact on the African savanna ecosystems in which they live.
A bottom of the food chain type of thing.
Well, right. I mean, we often think of creatures at the bottom of the food chain having a large impact, especially if you think of very tiny creatures that live in the ocean, because they're eaten by larger creatures and larger creatures eat them all the way up. So if something happens to these very tiny creatures, it has a really dramatic impact on the whole ecosystem. That's sort of seen as something that's almost passive because these tiny creatures are just sort of being eaten. But with the termites, we're seeing something a bit more active. These termites, as you might know, Rob, are actually very good builders. So they build these very large mounds. It can take even centuries to build these big dirt mounds in the African savanna. You can see a really cool picture of one of these mounds on the site. But the termites don't just build these mounds. They aerate them. They act like little earthworms in farm soil, where they create these holes in the dirt that allows rain and other water to get in to really penetrate them. And also the termites, when they're digging through these mounds, they're, for lack of a better word, pooping in the mounds. So they're fertilizing the mounds. That causes a lot of grass to form on the mounds. And so they're really creating these very fertile patches of earth. And in the places where you don't see the mounds, you don't see as much. The soil is not as enriched with important compounds like nitrogen and phosphorus. And so in this new study, researchers said, these termites really seem to be making a very dramatic impact on the soil. Are they also having a very dramatic impact on the entire ecosystem, because so many creatures rely on soil fertility in one way or the other, from very small creatures to very large creatures?
So a survey then of what's growing near these mounds?
Exactly. Researchers went out into the African savanna and they wanted to quantify, you know, what kind of things were growing near these mounds and what kind of things were attracted to the mounds. And one of the first things they noticed was the mounds tend to attract acacia trees, which were a very abundant type of tree seen in the African savanna. And not only were there a lot more trees near these mounds, but the trees near these mounds grew up to 60% more new shoots, and they were more than twice as likely to bear fruit. So the trees near these mounds were a lot more fertile than trees that were not near the termite mounds. And then there was this whole almost kind of like a snowball effect that the researchers noticed. Once you had these acacia trees drew in a lot of insects. And the researchers set traps near the mounds, and they found that they were collecting about 40% more insects near the mounds than in places that were not near the mounds. And continuing the snowball effect, these insects draw in larger animals, animals like geckos, and the researchers found that geckos were about twice as likely to be found near the mounds than they were found in other places. And there was other effects of the mounds too. These mounds grow a lot of grass on them because the soil is so fertile, and this grass is a magnet essentially for very large animals. Grazing animals like zebra and buffalo also tend to congregate near the mounds. So you've got these very tiny termites that spend their days building these mounds, and they are having such a dramatic effect on the ecosystem. They're drawing in all these plants, all these small animals, all these large animals that really, at the end of the day, really depend on these mounds that these termites build for survival.
Now, termites commonly, at least in the United States, are thought of as pests. Is that how they're thought of also in Africa?
Yeah, actually, they are. African farmers really don't like termites. They think that they compete with cattle for grass. And what this study really shows is that it's the other way around. You know, cattle and other grazing animals really depend on termites to provide conditions that grow grass. And the researchers are hoping that this work will convince the farmers that it's really in their best interest to leave the termites alone.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, we've got a story about active galactic nuclei. And these are very large black holes, which release enormous amounts of energy. And scientists have never really been clear how these black holes form. But now scientists think they've solved that mystery. And as you know, Rob, when researchers last week announced that they had created a genome from scratch and used it to power a cell, that was a really huge breakthrough in synthetic biology. And we asked readers last week to submit their questions. You know, this breakthrough poses a lot of really interesting biological as well as ethical questions. And we asked readers to submit some of their most pressing questions. We did a Q&A with a couple of experts last week that answered readers' questions, and you can find those questions and those answers on the site. And for Science Insider, the science policy blog, we've got a story about a prestigious science prize that's named after a dictator and all the controversy that's ensuing because of that. And also, we continue to follow the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, specifically the science of things like dispersants, what the effect of the spill is going to be on coastal ecosystems, on animals that live in the sea. We've got a nice site we've developed just for that that has some of the most pressing questions about the oil spill, and that's being updated every day. And you can find a link to that and all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter from our May 7th issue in response to, as the authors write, the recent escalation of political assaults on scientists in general and on climate scientists in particular. Peter Glick of the Pacific Institute, along with 254 co-authors from institutions across the United States and around the world, write about how there is always uncertainty in science.
The authors write, "There is always some uncertainty associated with scientific conclusions. Science never absolutely proves anything. When someone says that society should wait until scientists are absolutely certain before taking any action, it is the same as saying society should never take action. For a problem as potentially catastrophic as climate change, taking no action poses a dangerous risk for our planet."
The authors continue, "Like all human beings, scientists make mistakes, but the scientific process is designed to find and correct them. This process is inherently adversarial. Scientists build reputations and gain recognition not only for supporting conventional wisdom, but even more so for demonstrating that the scientific consensus is wrong and that there is a better explanation. That's what Galileo, Pasteur, Darwin, and Einstein did. But when some conclusions have been thoroughly and deeply tested, questioned, and examined, they gain the status of well-established theories and are often spoken of as facts."
The authors conclude, "We urge our policymakers and the public to move forward immediately to address the causes of climate change, including the unrestrained burning of fossil fuels. We also call for an end to McCarthy-like threats of criminal prosecution against our colleagues based on innuendo and guilt by association, the harassment of scientists by politicians seeking distractions to avoid taking action, and the outright lies being spread about them. Society has two choices. We can ignore the science and hide our heads in the sand and hope we are lucky, or we can act in the public interest to reduce the threat of global climate change quickly and substantively. The good news is that smart and effective actions are possible, but delay must not be an option."
You can read the full letter in the May 7th issue of Science. Our next letter is in response to Zhenghua Liu's policy forum from April 2nd, titled China's Road to Sustainability. In that policy forum, Liu describes the complex set of forces that have affected China's sustainability over the past six decades and offers perspectives for the future.
In response, Chang Wang of the Chinese Academy of Science writes that Liu overlooked an important cultural force. China's worsening environmental conditions have catalyzed a spirit of environmental activism. Recent years have witnessed an impressive growth in environmental protests in China. The number of petitions and mass public protests related to environmental issues has increased by 30% per year in the past few years, although the number of petitions lodged with the Chinese government has dropped.
Wong describes several of these protests and notes that they have several common characteristics. One, they are confined to one specific geographical space. Two, their goal is protecting the environment rather than political rights or commercial interests. Three, they focus on a specific pollutant rather than general environmental degradation. In conclusion, Wong writes, the local nature of the movement enables the organization of a large number of citizens with very little effort in a very short time. Given more open social and political conditions and the increasing size of the middle class in China, environmental civilian activism will certainly be a key driver in China's transition to sustainability.
You can read Wong's full letter, along with a related letter by Glenn Peters and colleagues that addresses the rapid economic growth that is not offset by efficiency improvements, in the May 14th issue of Science. Our final letter is in response to John Cohen's News Focus story, In the Shadow of Jane Goodall, from April 2nd.
Iriko Keke from Haverford College writes in to say that she was fascinated by the progress in behavioral research, but disconcerted to learn that, 50 years after this research began, only one of 18 long-term chimpanzee and bonobo research sites has a lead researcher who is an African scientist. In addition, only one up-and-coming African field manager was profiled in the article. It is possible that some of the foreign research leaders are Africans based elsewhere, but the overall picture is one of the foreign dominance that has persisted for generations. This unfortunate picture casts conservation efforts that accompany research as externally imposed, thereby undermining their effectiveness. It is also self-perpetuating, creating few role models for younger African scientists.
Ukeke concludes, the situation with chimpanzee and bonobo field research is sadly reflective of many areas of science in Africa. Because of its long history and impressive growth, this example suggests that the lopsidedness of research leadership in Africa will not be corrected by the traditional research apprenticeship model. Projects necessarily located in Africa must build local human resources to the highest level, even if this means that they will lose their most valued trainees to new Africa-led projects. Generating local leaders must be a deliverable goal for such projects, and one in which funders of long-term research projects need to be invested.
You can find OKK's letter in this week's issue of Science.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
And now to the results of the survey, the unscientific survey about unconventional journals.
We received over 1,000 responses from people all over the world. The results: 50% said yes, the benefits of non-peer-reviewed journals, such as medical hypotheses, outweigh the risks. 38% said no, and about 11% were not sure.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the May 28th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.